Welcome to the BIOS podcast by Ilix Ventures. BIOS is a community of early stage healthcare and life sciences founders and investors. BIOS curates content, hosts events, crafts resources, and creates a community to facilitate collaboration. BIOS unites like-minded members of the startup universe and is anchored by Ilix Ventures, a San Francisco-based venture fund that invests in early stage healthcare and life sciences companies. To learn more about us, visit bios.community or ilix.vc.
Hello and welcome to BIOS Podcast. Today, we're absolutely thrilled to welcome Holden Thorpe, Editor-in-Chief at Science Journals. Holden, thank you once again for joining us.
It's great to be on with you guys.
Let's kick things off. Holden, can you rewind the clock and share a little bit more about your background and give a short career overview with ourselves and our audience,
please? Yeah, well, I grew up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I grew up in the theater. My mom ran the community theater in my hometown. I was the guy at the theater who fixed everything because I was a terrible actor. And when I went to college, you know, thanks to the fact that I had had a great high school chemistry teacher, I decided to get a chemistry degree, and I thought I was going to be pre-med, like most kids from small towns who go to college to study chemistry. But along the way, I got involved in undergraduate research, working with Tom Meyer, who is a well-known inorganic chemist, and fell in love with being in the laboratory and decided at the last minute to go to chemistry graduate school. And I went to Caltech and worked for Harry Gray doing inorganic photochemistry. And then I went to Yale and did my postdoc on photosynthesis. And then I went first to NC State for 2 years and then to the University of North Carolina as an independent faculty member. And I did that for 15 years. And then I went into administration and I was the chair of the chemistry department, the dean of arts and sciences, and eventually the chancellor. And after some adventures as chancellor, which some of which were good and some not so great, I decided private higher education was a better place to apply my trade. So I went to Washington University in St. Louis, where I was the provost. And after 6 years doing that, I decided to get out of administration and was really fortunate that I had the opportunity to become the editor of the Science family of journals, which is one of the greatest jobs in all of science.
I have to agree, and we're excited to hear more about the role shortly. But it also seems like you learned a thing or two from your time in the theater, because not only do you have a great storytelling ability, also a strong podcast voice. So,
if my mom was still alive, she would be very proud to hear you say that.
I am always glad to make a mother proud, but taking a step back for a moment, you clearly had a large number of experiences throughout your career. Help our audience get a grasp of what has your North Star been, the common thread, if you will, that has tied your work together.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear that it's always been sort of the unfettered opportunity for faculty, mostly scientists, but because I was a dean and a provost, that also includes humanists and social scientists, to be able to follow their curiosity, study what they want to, and to do it in an environment where people were getting an education. I have to say, though, you know, one thing that's pretty clear from my career is that I certainly don't see teaching as being inextricable from academic life, and even to the point where I don't have a lab anymore, but I still teach my classes, and I'm pretty sure I always will. I've recently moved my faculty appointment to George Washington University, where I'm professor of chemistry and medicine, and I still have my class going there, and really enjoy doing that.
Oh, and they're lucky to have you. And to dive into that and a little bit more of your background, I'm going to pass it to my co-host, Tripp.
Thank you again, Chris. And thank you again so much, Holden. We're so excited to dive in here, starting within your background and just diving in a little deeper. And just as you're mentioning, Holden, just as an American chemist, a key thought leader, professor, entrepreneur, we have so many questions to dive in and around your own history and just the future predictions that we'd love to hear on your own perspective. But first, I'd just love to start with some questions within your academic background in particular. So as you mentioned, from 2008 to 2013, you served as chancellor to UNC and being one of the youngest leaders of an academic institution in the United States, and from 2013 to 2019, you were the provost of Washington St. Louis. I mean, during this pivotal decade, you saw the academic model transition from one of translation in particular. As someone who authors so many incredible thought leadership pieces, I mean, we'd love to learn more about your time as a chancellor, as a provost that influenced your thinking. Do you have any advice around the current state of entrepreneurial science culture and academia today as someone who has led and seen this space evolve through time?
Yeah, well, I've been in all that for longer than almost anything else because I did my first startup in 1996, was a gene chip company. So I did that on the faculty side, and I did it again in the mid-2000s where I started Viamet Pharmaceuticals, which is a company that eventually produced a drug called VIVJOA, which is on the market now and is marketed by another company that acquired it called Mycovia Pharmaceuticals. So I've seen this from the faculty side, and I've also seen it from the administration side. And I think the number one problem we have in academia with all this is that we don't have enough people who have actually done this kind of thing in the leadership roles. And that makes it hard for institutions to be able to understand the complexity of a lot of the processes and also to convey to the faculty what they're going to be able to do to help them. You know, simply a matter of the fact that this isn't that old of a undertaking and there aren't that many people in these positions who've seen it all. You know, I'm one of the people who's done that, and there is a growing number of administrators who've done this sort of thing. And I think the good news is that the institutions are getting more comfortable with it, more comfortable with processes and patent law and the various things about licensing and managing the conflict of interest. But I think it's still true that there's still way too much bureaucracy that's built up around all of that. And if some of that down, that would be a good thing in the long run.
I mean, it's fantastic to hear your perspective. And I would love to continue diving into how you've seen the space evolve. Just given from your own industry experience, especially from the 90s, the early 2000s, these were defining decades for early stage biotech. And so just diving in from both your perspective as an entrepreneur and as an academic, it seems like there has been a lot surrounding bureaucracy or changing the own internal culture within academia to make it more applicative towards translation and the more entrepreneurial mindset. Would you say, I guess to rephrase this question or ask more directly, has this been something internal to academia, or are there specific indications that you're looking for to say, you know, these are the main focuses or changes that should happen to make academia more welcoming towards entrepreneurship? Or more in specific, what advice would you give to other folks in academia or other folks in administration currently that would be looking to more increase entrepreneurship or the innovation economy within their own universities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is to try to get the legal office and the tech transfer office to focus on a proactive way of doing things rather than one that is focused on protecting the institution from bad things that probably aren't going to happen. And, you know, part of that just comes with experience. But I think that a lot of VCs and industry folks get very frustrated that the universities are slow and very focused on, you know, liability protection and indemnification. And oftentimes the tech transfer office more focused on losing things than they are on gaining things that might work. I mean, every one of these ventures has a very low probability of success. And so the only way to win is to have a lot of them. If you slow them all down and worry about how to stop from losing something that probably doesn't exist, then you're going to slow down the process. Whereas if you push things through and have a lot of lines in the water, then your chance of catching a fish is going to be a whole lot higher. And also, in the meantime, you're not going to irritate your VC and faculty stakeholders who are involved in this kind of thing. So the most important deal here is to get people to be collaborative rather than everybody trying to protect their little piece of the turf, whether that's the conflict of interest policy or the legal documents or the terms of the license. Rather, everybody should be working towards actually getting these things done. And universities have a hard time with that in general. It's not just in the entrepreneurial space. If you look at getting clinical trials approved or even, you know, simple things like construction, parking, universities have a tendency to get very bogged down in all their offices and bureaucrats and policies. And it takes experienced administrators to cut through all this. And unfortunately, the work of doing that isn't all that glamorous. Most search committees are looking for new administrators who started new initiatives or move schools up in rankings. And they don't get too excited about somebody who fixed some bureaucratic problem. And so unfortunately, there's not enough emphasis on straightening a lot of these things out in these institutions. That's one of the reasons why I got out. I like to fix things, and I fixed a lot of things at UNC and a lot of things at WashU. But the rewards for doing that are not as high as they are for starting new things, some of which just add to the bureaucracy because of what they are. And so we really need a reset in terms of the expectations that people have of administrators when it comes to this kind of thing.
Certainly. And it also lends to the talent question as well, as you were mentioning, how new folks in academia are being judged or scored in regards to new positions. And I'm glad you lended towards that transition from academia. And as you mentioned this transition, you then became editor-in-chief at Science Magazine. While we're at this moment, as we're talking about that transition from academia, could you just briefly, just to start here, could you tell us just what motivated this switch to begin with?
Yeah, so I had a rough ride as chancellor at UNC, which anybody listening to this can find out with Google. I'm the person who basically found the athletics problems at UNC having to do with classes that weren't as rigorous as they should have been for athletes. I untangled that the best I could, and I had a good advisor who told me, once I got started untangling them, the best thing to do was going to be to leave, because I was going to be a reminder to people, even though I didn't have anything to do with it, of the problem. And, you know, that's just luck is involved in these jobs. And I hit a string of bad luck there. But that was good advice, because I was able to get my next position at WashU relatively easily and certainly quickly. I didn't have any space between those two jobs. And I had a great time at WashU. Mark Wrighton was the chancellor, and he and I are both scientists, and we thought the same way. And he loved it when I straightened out problems for him. And I love doing that because it's a great place, and he was an excellent and supportive boss. So I think a lot of people figured, you know, I'd go do another presidency after that. And I talked to places that had openings, but when it came down to it and I had to kind of decide whether to take one of these, I just decided I didn't have the fire in the belly anymore to do these things. And I'm glad, because it's gotten a lot more challenging since I got out. COVID was really hard, and now people are really struggling with how to deal with their campuses in light of the conflict in the Middle East right now. So I'm glad I'm not dealing with any of that anymore. And so what I did was I just told the search consultants, okay, I'm done doing these jobs. Don't put me in another one of these president searches, because when it gets to the end, not going to take it, and start bringing me other stuff. And I assumed it would be a foundation or a museum or something like that. But one of the search consultants said, I think I got something even better for you. And they brought me this opportunity. And the second I saw it, I knew it was absolutely perfect. I had thought that science would want somebody who had a little more of a glamorous scientific career than I had. I always tell people, you know, if all the papers you submit to science when you're a scientist get rejected, apparently you can still become the editor in chief. Because science rejected all of the papers that I sent them. Fortunately, that turned out not to be a disqualifier. And I think it's also probably been a good thing that, you know, I had a lot of these organizational experiences because we've been able to straighten out a lot of administrative problems that we had, and happy to be able to do that. So I basically just, you know, for the listeners here thinking about their career, you know, I did 15 years as a scientist in the lab. I did 15 years in administration. And with any luck, I'll do 15 years as a journal editor, and that'll be the end.
It certainly leads to, in review, how your career had evolved and following that passion as well. And it's amazing to see that transition and that journey moving away from academia to this switch. And I'd just love to dive a level deeper here, Holden. As we're talking about that switch and this being perfect for you and that opportunity, you know, I'd just love to ask two, you know, quicker questions is, you know, what made you passionate about switching from academia to the field of journalism? Were there exciting things or topics, you know, aside from yourself being a fixer, right, within administration? And, you know, what also just sparked your interest to join science in particular as an organization? Maybe it was the rejection, I'm unsure.
Oh, no, it wasn't that. It was really the blend of things that you get to do and how it took advantage of a lot of the things that I knew how to do. I mean, it's true that I'm not in academia, certainly not in administration in the same way that I was before, but almost all of our authors are, and the reviewers and everybody are in universities. So knowing how they work and knowing what's going on in those institutions is certainly a big asset. And, you know, it's such a great job because you get to do three things that are all really fun. First is help the editors decide what to publish in the most high profile place almost in the world that they can be published, and to work with people who are the editors who span everything from, you know, I always say sociology all the way to quantum computing and everything in between. And if you've been a provost, which is a similar breadth, then that's very good preparation for that. So the research side is awesome. I get to see a lot of stuff before it goes big. Then there's the news section, and news is editorially independent. So I don't get to tell them what to write, but I can help them when they ask me. And also, of course, I deal with any challenges that they might have with people complaining about their news coverage and stuff like that. And then we have the commentary section where I get to write the editorial on the editorial page of roughly every other week and lots of other things on the website, and then manage all of the things we have in our commentary section, which we think of as the best place in the world for scientists to talk to each other. And again, that's another thing that I've devoted a lot of my effort to in the past. So it's really a dream job for a scientist, and Washington, D.C. is a great place to live, and the people I work with are brilliant, and there's 160 of them, which sounds like a lot, but in my other jobs, I had tens of thousands of people that I was responsible for, so it's doable from a management perspective also.
Of course, I think that's a fantastic foray and just overview into your time at science and where your passion really lies in this moment. So while we're taking a dive into here, I just want to pass this over to my colleague Chris here for a quick halftime rapid fire just on trends and predictions, just on the space of journalism as a whole. So Chris, feel free to take it away. Thank you again, Holden.
Sure.
Thank you, Drew. Thank you, Holden. As Drew mentioned, we'd love to take a moment to get your quick thoughts on the scientific journalism space at large. And it's been fascinating hearing more about your background in academia and how it's overlapped and influenced your thinking. But in your opinion, to maybe take a step back, what is the mission of scientific journals? And how do you think, for example, that differs from scientific journalism? For example, the difference between science and STEM.
Yeah, so we're both, right? We have the research side and we also have news. And news in some ways competes with STAT if it's on a medical topic. So the science, so the journals are promoting and publishing research findings and in pretty technical language. And the journalism side is writing that about those same findings in a more accessible way. Probably for science and STAT, mostly accessible to other scientists. But then, of course, mainstream outlets also cover our research papers, and that's something we put a lot of effort into, and that's really where the public sees the fruits of our efforts in on the research side. And, of course, the journalism side also writes about the culture of science and the behavior of scientists and important changes that we need to see in science, and that's a very important function as well. So they do two different things. There's certainly a lot of overlap because our news writers certainly understand the technical details of the papers they're reading, but not at the depth that our research editors do.
That makes a lot of sense. And it feels like we've talked a lot about what scientific journals are over the conversation so far. And we'd love to ask maybe what are some misconceptions about them as well?
Oh, the biggest misconception by far is the amount of reach that we have. So to people in the world of science, science is the tippy top publication. We have the most followers on Twitter. We have the most people on our Instagram account. We have 4 million unique people on our website every month. And so this all sounds really, really big. But in a world where information is flowing at the rate that it's flowing, you know, we're small. And I think a lot of people ask me things like, well, how come Joe Rogan can have so much influence over people doubting vaccines and you can't just counteract that? Well, it's very simple. We have 4 million people a month on our website. Joe Rogan has 100 million people listening to his podcast. So to us, science is big, but to the public, most people haven't even heard of science. If I tell them I'm the editor of Science, they'll usually ask me, oh, did you mean Scientific American? Because that's something they heard of. And the answer to that is no. And I have to say science, you know, and they say science, you mean all of it? And I say yes. And so, you know, I think the biggest misconception is just the difference between how influential science is in the world of science and how much relatively little influence it has beyond that. I mean, we know that policymakers read the front half of the journal. Certainly the staffers in the congressional offices do. We know that our newsletter gets read by a lot of folks. And this is a great time for me to tell everyone, please sign up for Science Advisor on our website. It's very easy to do. Just give us your email. You'll get Science Advisor in your inbox every day. And we think you'll really enjoy it if you're listening to this podcast, that's for sure. But compared to if something is in a mainstream media outlet or if it's on one of these high profile podcasts, you know, we're reaching two orders of magnitude fewer people generally than any of those outlets would.
And that's something we hope to, as I think an industry, try to change and address as we try to make science more accessible, just as you were talking about earlier. And as someone who has their pulse on the research and scientific, their finger on the pulse, forgive me, of the research and scientific space, your job is to know and pull together all of this information in addition to sharing your opinions as a thought leader. So as we think about that volume of information and its dissemination to such a distributed audience, how do you build these sources and how do you personally take it all in?
Yeah, well, a lot of people ask me if I read it all. There's absolutely no way I could do that. Just to get a print issue of Science and read absolutely every word in it would probably take you the whole week. And then another one would come around. So I have to trust the people that I work with significantly, and thankfully I do. The editors who handle the papers that are in there really know more about those papers than almost anyone, even sometimes the authors. And the news folks are very involved in tracking their stories down. So I trust everything that's in there. And, you know, I mainly focus on the things that are going to get a lot of attention, either because they're big breakthroughs or because they're going to be controversial or because they're a news story that some people might object to. And I spend most of my time on that. You know, I get various briefings and things about what's in there. And so I can kind of generally see where things are going. But as far as the research side, you know, there's a pyramid of editors. Val DeVinson, who's our executive editor, who's responsible for life sciences and leading the research side of all the journals. And then we have Jake Yeston, who does physical sciences for us. Lisa Chong, who does our commentary section. Tim Appenzeller, who does our news section. And those folks are responsible for all the content.
I love the focus on team and the way you're thinking about bringing people together who have that different expertise. As we think about that community angle, what advice would you give to the life science community at large about being more informed?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's two things. One is don't go crazy trying to process it all, because there's so much information out there. So pick your tools and your ways of assimilating things. And when there are things you missed or you didn't know, just go learn them. Don't worry about the fact that you didn't get them. Nobody can keep up with all that stuff. And then the second thing, and I see this a lot, is don't take the culture of your particular subdiscipline, whatever it is, and expect that people are in a different field think the same way you do. This is something I deal with a lot in my world, especially when you have physical science and life sciences. But even within the areas of life science, ecologists are very different from cancer biologists, who are very different from microbiology researchers. Each of these subdisciplines has its own unique culture and norms and ways of doing things. And when you're interacting with somebody from a different part of science, you have to recognize that they have more expertise in their subdiscipline, not only in the subject matter, but also how the discipline works than you do. And it's very important to be respectful of that.
I really love that focus. And as we think about expanding now from beyond just people within the industry to the general public at large, is there any advice you would have for those maybe not coming from deeper scientific backgrounds on how to stay more informed on scientific topics? And maybe even to expand that question as what we in the scientific industry can do to better inform those who don't have the backgrounds we do.
Yeah, well, I think with social media undergoing this enormous fragmentation that it's going through as a result of Twitter, in my opinion, falling apart. That's a matter of personal opinion, but I don't think it's the kind of source that it was 2 years ago for science. Everybody's coming up with their own way of getting information, whether that be from alternative microblogging platforms like Blue Sky or Threads or whatever it happens to be, or staying on Twitter and dealing with all of the challenges there. But a lot of people, and this always mystifies me because I don't really love email as a platform, but a lot of people are getting their information from email. So I certainly think that we prepare a science advisor at a level that certainly is good for scientists, but hopefully is accessible to some people outside science. But there are other newsletters and podcasts and other things people can use as their tools to get this material. And, you know, just to go back to how important it is when research is covered in the media, very few people read journal articles by comparison to other kinds of publications. And many, many more people read mainstream news outlets. So if you read a news story in the New York Times or another national outlet that says something about some research study, and it says, as reported in the journal Science, many, many more, probably three orders of magnitude more or more people are reading that than are reading the research paper. So that being accurate is something we put a lot of attention in. And if you read a news story about a science paper in a big outlet, either it's accurate because we worked on it, or if there's an error, we're going to get that error corrected. And so you can trust that. Not everybody, not every journal has the resources that we have for doing that. But I think that excellent science reporters at mainstream outlets do a good job promoting the journal articles that they're covering, and they know a lot about how to do that, and we certainly work with them to always help them do it even better.
Love that, fostering the community for support. One final question here in the rapid fire. As someone who's been a key thought leader for years yourself, what would you give as advice to emerging opinion leaders who are trying to achieve some of these same goals of distributed information?
Yeah, well, it's a noisy environment. And unfortunately, it's an environment that mostly rewards you when you say something that's edgy. That was easy for me at one point when Donald Trump was the president, because he said a lot of things about science that were outrageous. And I could get a lot of clicks by, pointing out in a entertaining way why he was wrong. But, you know, in the end, that kind of cynicism is not a solution to anything. So it's a good way to build your following. But once you build it, you got to ask yourself, okay, what am I going to do with that? I wish there was a way to build a following by just saying things in a bland way that's supportive for everyone. But that's not the way our media environment works. So I think the best you can do is to say, okay, I'm going to be pretty edgy and controversial as I build my following and say things that people are going to want to read and going to click on. But then once I've done that, what am I going to do with it? What's the goal of building this following? Is it just to get more adrenaline that comes from people liking your stuff? Or is it because in the long run, you have some kind of goal?
Well, starting with a goal in mind makes a lot of sense. And to dive into that a little bit further, as we talk about telling the stories of science, going to pass it back to Drew.
Thanks so much, Chris. And as Chris was mentioning, just diving into your role as editor-in-chief of science journals, especially taking into the account of the breadth of research just being pursued around the world, for you personally, how do you disseminate good science in the most efficient and effective manner, whether it be your team, whether it be yourself personally? There's a lot of information. And as you mentioned, within social media and that advent, a lot of hype, right? So I'd be curious from your own perspective, just your own journey there.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, for us, getting a well-reviewed, well-vetted science paper and getting it covered in a major national news outlet, and, you know, usually a lot of them, is a good recipe for us. And, you know, we particularly love it when things are picked up in excellent newsletters like Stat and Nature Briefing and Axios Science. We get a lot of ink in those in addition to our own newsletter. So that's kind of what we're looking for. And I think, you know, the lesson that we see over and over again is that we all do, every scientist does to some extent, a lousy job of reminding people that this is just what we know now. Science is done by human beings who make mistakes. It's done by teams of people. It's done by determining the best interpretation of the data we have so far. And we tend to like to show it in a way that says, here's this one person who's making this pronouncement. And, you know, there are lots of things in the culture of science that hurt that because, you know, popular media figures can become very overemphasized in the discourse. And we give Nobel Prizes to only three people when it's for usually something that thousands of people have done. And we don't like to tell people that, oh, I'm telling you something now, but it might change when I do another experiment. And until we get to the point where we can do those things, we're going to continue to have these cycles of scientists saying things and then having it to be revised and having people skeptical of science because we had to do that when, in fact, that's what scientists always do.
Of course, I think it tends to a larger question as well as what the future holds in hand as a journalism organization. It's amazing to see from your own perspective how you're leading science in particular, Holden. And I wanted to focus in on that one outlet in particular. So as we're talking about science as a journal, Holden, you all publish not only the outcomes of incredible scientific discoveries, but also host podcasts, have career pages, you know, share news articles, posts, opinion pieces, and just so much more of the breadth around science in general. As we think about your time within the organization and we consider your background in academia and as an early stage bioinnovator, both as an entrepreneur and a VC, you know, as your own perspective, how have you defined the direction of the journal in particular in your time at Science?
Yeah, I hope that we have strengthened the voice of science and gotten a little bit more assertive in terms of telling the scientific community and occasionally people beyond that why science is important and a little bit more about how it's done. I hope that we have improved. I know statistically we have. We probably haven't done it enough yet, and there are a lot of people who still want more from us, but I hope we've done better at correcting the scientific record more quickly. We've published more retractions and editorial expressions of concern by about a factor of two. We probably need to get that up even more, but we're going to need the scientific community to help us realize that humans make mistakes and sometimes we have to correct them. And I hope we've gotten a different group of people, certainly in our commentary pages we have, and certainly the news side has broadened out the types of science and scientists they cover in the U.S. and around the world. And I think on the research side, we've done less than I would like, but I think we've made some progress at helping people who aren't just the normal folks who get papers in science get to publish with us. And we need to do even more on that. But that's something I'm very focused on.
Of course. And as we're talking about this publishing landscape, obviously the necessity of retractions and corrections, given the constantly shifting landscape of bio and science at large, you know, how do you personally keep a pulse on the science while also choosing what to publish and establish as science as a whole?
Well, the good news is I don't do any of that myself. I mean, we have, of course, for the Science Journal, a team of editors, all of whom are tasked with various areas that they cover. And they're the ones who decide that. And it's and largely based on, and this is something that people sometimes are unsure about, it's largely based on the stuff that gets sent in. I mean, we can't publish a paper if somebody doesn't send it to us. So we try to get the word out that we're looking for stuff. But in the end, we can only process the papers that are submitted. So to some extent, the distribution of papers in the journal is a function of the distribution of what gets sent to us as far, certainly as far as the fields go. So, I don't absolutely have to keep up with what's going on with anything in science because I have such a great team that I work with. But if you were to ask me, you know, the kinds of things that I'm focused on scientifically, I would say certainly AI is everywhere and people really love talking about it. And we talk a lot about not large language models, of course, since that seems to be something everybody wants to talk about right now, but also the applications of AI to clinical medicine or to the protein folding, materials synthesis. I mean, we're seeing all kinds of amazing applications of AI to things, and it raises all kinds of concerns about ethics and reproducibility, and we have to spend a lot of time thinking about that. I think with the pandemic, we spent a lot of time on microbiology and on public health of infectious diseases, and the questions having to do with what happens when you handle infectious agents. That's certainly a topic that was of great importance. So it varies a little bit from time to time, but I would say the big themes have been in the life sciences have been COVID and then AI. We're also very concerned about the future of the planet and climate change, and we get a lot of things talking about that. So those are some areas I spend some time thinking about.
Amazing to see what you're focused on, both historically and in the current state, Holden. I'm glad for a moment that you touched on the pandemic and during your own time there with science and not in academia as well, right? Dealing with science and leading that team during the COVID pandemic. One thing I would like to ask or just dive into in particular with the COVID-19 pandemic in general, journals were able to quickly review and return relevant information and major milestones to the public, providing just a much needed resource during the global time of need. Were there things from this crisis situation that you took from in time that were learnings or tips that you had? What changed or what do you believe needs to be changed to be there for the next crisis as far as learnings or other adjustments that you as a journal needed during that time in the pandemic when science and research and publishing was such an important need at that time?
Yeah, well, we learned that we could send everybody home and still get the journals out and do it quickly, as you said, and get the relevant papers out with relatively little colossal errors, at least for us. There were some for some of our brothers and sisters in publishing, which could have easily happened to us, but fortunately they didn't, not in a big way. And I think in general, the number of big mistakes that happened, given how fast everybody was doing everything, was, you know, commendably low. I think, and I mean, we were making it up as we go along. I always tell the story, you know, in February of 2020, we were still in the building and Valda Vinson came into my office and she said, "Good news, I got the structure of the spike protein." And I said, "Great, what's the spike protein?" And 3 weeks later, we published it. And last time I checked, it had been cited about 4,000 times. So it's a testament to how quickly we were able to get things done. And, you know, we certainly, I don't know, I wouldn't say enjoyed, but we benefited from working with people that we had already known. And I guess what that tells you is that the relationships are really important to cultivate ahead of time, because once the crisis happens, you're not going to be cultivating a lot of new relationships. I used to say in my administrative jobs that the first thing I wanted to do was meet the police chief and the fire chief, because the last thing I wanted to do was meet them for the first time at a emergency.
Of course, that seems like a fantastic guidance towards an up and coming crisis or any adjustments towards the future in regards to journalism or just crisis management in general as a leader. So I appreciate you sharing that, Holden. And I appreciate you diving into the learnings and adjustments you all have made within the pandemic and beyond as well. So to pivot slightly, we would just love to ask your thoughts on the future of scientific dissemination and the intersections of research and peer review, just journalism and entrepreneurship as a whole. To begin with, and as we close up the episode here, as we've talked about the adjustments, the requirements needed towards the future of science, is, you know, how do you view the future of scientific journalism from your perspective, Holden?
Yeah, well, I think as far as journals are concerned, there are a lot of changes going on. I think the biggest one, and the one that I like the best, that seems to have taken hold across everything, is the use of preprints. We encourage people to post their research in a preprint. That's good for us because we get to see how the community reacts to it, and it's a good way to pick up any problems that might be there. It's good for other researchers because the peer review process doesn't hold up them seeing the results for the first time. And there's no downside because we find that if a preprint has been published on a paper, when we publish it, it doesn't change the amount of news coverage it gets or the number of citations that it eventually gets. So preprints are definitely a great change. There are a lot of things going on around the scientific review process itself, and we're monitoring all of those. We haven't dramatically changed the way we're doing reviews or anything, but when we look at eLife and what they're trying with the reviewed preprints, or just some of our other journals who are publishing, some of the other journals outside of our world who are publishing reviews or disclosing who reviewers are, we continue to watch these experiments. We tend to be one of the last folks to move because when we do, given our profile, it tends to have a big effect on the industry. And so we like to get as much data about whether something's going to work before we do it or not, so that we don't send people off in the wrong direction. So we're watching all these experiments, but I think preprints are here to stay. We're very enthusiastic about them, and there's absolutely no data to suggest that that's harming science in any way.
Thank you again, Holden. It's exciting to see the future from your perspective and how you're looking at the industry as a whole. I want to quickly pass it over to Chris here to close up the episode with a few rapid fire questions. Thanks again, Holden, so much for your time. It was an absolute
great talking to you.
So as Drew said, Holden, before we come to a close, just a few final questions to wrap things up. One question we love to ask our guests comes from Nobel laureate Denis Gabor, who said, "The future cannot be predicted, but the future can be invented." As someone who's always reviewing and publishing and commenting on what inventions are emerging today, we'd love to ask what inventing the future means to you.
I think it means looking in places where people haven't looked before and having the courage to do so carefully and not in a sort of mass production kind of, I think there's an awful lot of emphasis on doing more science, and it's better to have a focus on doing creative science that hasn't been done before and to do it carefully.
I like that message. And as we think about doing science carefully and as we think about moving forward, what would you say are some of the grand challenges facing the life sciences today?
I think that from a pharmaceutical's point of view, if we're going to have more antibodies, figuring out how to deliver them better without injections would be a really good thing. In terms of problems to work on, boy, we could sure use a small molecule that you could put in a pill for rheumatoid arthritis and other kinds of inflammatory conditions. It would be great. Probably the best thing we could do for society would be to come up with a effective non-opioid pain medicine. There's promising stuff out there, but it continues to be pretty early. Certainly something we watch for very carefully. It would be great to be able to treat real pain and to do it with something that wasn't going to permanently mess up your life, like opioid pain medicine would do. I think that psychedelics in addiction looks like something to work to try to track down. I can't tell if that's going to work or not, but I'm sure curious about it. So those are a few things in life sciences that I think are, and then, you know, really anything in mental health. is crucial. I do think I would have said metabolic disease, you know, a few years ago, but we're kind of in a boom when it comes to metabolic disease with GLP-1. So I'd say for now, we ought to push that as far as we can push it and see what else we have to do in metabolic disease. But that's an area that affects people who don't always have resources. And so I'm excited to see us get the cost of these GLP-1 drugs down and see how much they can benefit society.
And fingers crossed that each of these areas is going to move forward and relatively quickly. As we think about that and as we move forward today, though, how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Oh, they can just go to science.org. They can follow me on Blue Sky, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Threads. And they can see my blog on Substack and another one on our website. And I'll for sure put this episode on all of those platforms, and we'll see.
We love sharing and promoting your content, and we appreciate that you're going to be doing the same with this episode here. It's been a great conversation. And before we sign off, we've talked a lot about professional things, and we've heard a little bit more about your passion, your mission. We'd just love to ask something personal quickly and just say, Holden, what do you like to do for fun?
Oh, well, I'm a longtime musician. I went to the Berklee College of Music for the summer and 1981. That's when I began my my career in higher education, in a way. I still play the bass guitar and the upright bass, and I tend to play for a lot of pit orchestras for musicals at colleges and community theaters, and always coming to a theater near you.
Love to hear that. And so thank you, Holden, again for joining us for an absolutely fantastic episode. We're very grateful for your time. Thank you again.
Great. Really great to be on with you guys. Thanks for doing all this for the world.